You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It was over a year ago in January of 2021 when officials at Interfaith Sanctuary Homeless Shelter in downtown Boise said it was buying a building on State Street. Now, the plan was to move Interfaith to a much bigger building and double the shelter's ability to serve people who are experiencing homelessness. So fast forward to today. At 4 this afternoon, the Boise City Council will start 5 days of testimony, both for and against Interfaith's move to State Street. After that, they will take a vote that will decide the shelter's future, one way or the other. Senior reporter Margaret Carmel has been covering this story for BoiseDev.com since it started, and she is joining us live now. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, Gemma. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. So, Margaret, as we begin, can you just give us a quick background in Interfaith Sanctuary and what it does exactly?
Well, it's hard to do a quick background on this story because we've had many twists and turns, but Interfaith Sanctuary is one of Boise's emergency homeless shelters. They currently serve anybody who doesn't have a place to stay. You can show up and get a bed there, or at least get a line there, or get in line there. And unlike Boise Rescue Mission, they don't have faith-based programming. They are LGBTQ affirming. So if you're transgender, you will be in a dorm that corresponds with your gender identity. And they also don't have sobriety requirements. They're what's considered a low barrier shelter, which is essentially if you follow the rules and do your chores and are respectful and don't, cause violence or fight anyone, you can stay at that shelter.
Okay. So with that said, why did the sanctuary want to buy the building on State Street and move its entire operations there?
So Interfaith has been tight on space for a long time. They only have a relatively small amount of beds. I don't remember the exact count, but it's well under 200 for both men, women, and families with children prior to their expansion into hotel rooms during the pandemic. And so they regularly have to turn people away or have people sleep on mats on the floor during the coldest months of the year and the hottest times of the year. They also don't have as much space for day operations. So there, when you walk into the shelter, they have a main room that is their cafeteria. It also becomes a sleeping mat area at night. It is where they have meeting rooms. It is kind of an all-purpose space. It's an old warehouse. So they wanted to relocate to the State Street property and expand. Reporting that I did showed that Executive Director Jody Peterson-Steigers was looking at other properties in downtown Boise. She approached a couple motels, other properties, and they just were out of the shelter's price range. So they found the old Salvation Army warehouse on State Street. They wanted to buy it and they engaged, they purchased it. It is sold. And now, and they sold their current building. And now they're waiting to find out if they have permission from the city of Boise to get a conditional use permit and move their operation there.
So Margaret, you've already been covering the problem of homelessness way before any of the issues with Interfaith Sanctuary came out. In fact, you had a story about people living in their cars in downtown Boise, and then you add the COVID-19 pandemic, which was just straining services for folks who were experiencing homelessness. So is it fair to say that this is not a new problem that we are seeing here?
No, definitely not. And as Boise's population grows, we're only going to see more demand. Now, there's a lot of folks who are working on other solutions, housing first type solutions, rapidly rehousing people who lose their housing. But ultimately, Interfaith Sanctuary's argument is that the night by night crisis of people who need a place to stay now need more beds for those people, particularly more beds for those who don't feel comfortable staying at the Boise Rescue Mission for a variety of reasons. The other issue about the that Interfaith Sanctuary says means that they need more beds is that the Boise Rescue Mission divides folks by gender into different facilities. And so children, boys under 12 or over 12 cannot stay at the women's shelter. They must go to the men's shelter alone, which some people don't want to do that. Single fathers with children don't really have a place at the Boise Rescue Mission. So Interfaith's argument is that they need more, more beds as Boise grows, even as there are solutions for homelessness in other areas by other organizations.
Mm-hmm. And Margaret, you did some reporting on some really tense discussions that happened between Interfaith and the neighbors who live around where this shelter would potentially be moving to on State Street. What are some of these neighbors concerned about?
The neighborhood in Veterans Park has a lot of concerns about this project. They shared over 12 hours of testimony worth of concerns about it when this went through planning and zoning. They are worried about, essentially they argue that a low barrier emergency shelter does not belong next to a residential neighborhood. They have said that the people there will be a security risk to children who play in the park and are walking to school in this area. It's far from services in downtown. State Street is not walkable enough for people experiencing homelessness who often don't have cars. They also have argued that there are already other, low-income housing and permanent supportive housing for people experiencing homelessness in this area, and that neighborhood should not have to basically carry the burden of all of Boise's homeless services in that one area. They've raised worries about it tanking property values. I also saw presentations during the hearings from folks who said that basically they don't believe that Interfaith Sanctuary will adequately screen for sex offenders, which are not allowed to stay at Interfaith Sanctuary. And they raise concerns about sex offenders being in their neighborhood and harming children. They also raise concerns about just general crime and the questions. They felt that Interfaith Sanctuary didn't have enough of a security plan to patrol their neighborhood and ensure that the guests at their shelter or people who had been removed from their shelter would not impact their life.
So, Margaret, here's something that I found interesting. Interfaith, so they go and they buy this building. But then even before they buy the building, they had the opportunity to go and get the green light from the city of Boise. Why did they not do that before they bought this building, before they decided, you know what, we're going to move? I mean, because I don't think anyone should be surprised that there was pushback from these neighbors.
I think that's a difficult question for me to ask. You know, I obviously am not, you know, was not a fly in the wall on all of their conversations. Yeah. I'm not totally sure what went into all of those conversations, but you know, my talks with Jody Peterson Steigers, she's told me that they saw a building that they could afford and they moved. This is a very, very tight housing market. Properties, particularly lower price properties that would meet Interfaith specifications and is in their budget, are they go like crazy. And so, you know, Peterson Steigers has said to me a couple times, you know, we saw a building that we could afford and we bought it. And in order to buy that building, we had to sell our current building. That's what she has said to me and said to other folks publicly. Mm-hmm. And so that's a tricky balancing act where they needed the money to buy that building. And now we'll see what happens with this approval. Interfaith has said that they are possibly in danger of closing if they don't get this approval. But we don't know exactly how that's all going to play out if that happens. And it is very likely that this is going to stretch on beyond this week. Both sides have indicated a willingness to take this to court, which could then go for a judicial review, which could then be appealed to the Idaho Supreme Court. Interfaith said that the investment group that purchased their building is not willing to wait too much terribly longer for them to find a solution. But it's looking like we could not, we might still be talking about this a year from now. This is not a one and done type of deal.
Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce you, Margaret, for folks who are just joining us. We're talking with BoiseDev.com senior reporter Margaret Carmel about Interfaith Sanctuary's proposed move from downtown Boise to State Street. The city of Boise will be taking public hearing beginning at 4 p.m. today. This is going to be 5 days of hearings. So, Margaret, the city of Boise already held a series of hearings on homelessness. What was the goal there? And with that said, could the city force Interfaith to move to a different location if they wanted to do that? But I guess they'd have to have another location.
I think what you're referring to is the mayor's task force that she convened last summer in order to try to find a solution.
Correct.
She tapped several community leaders, neighborhood folks, faith leaders, people who are homeless themselves to sit on this task force and find a solution. But by the end of that, I think it was an 8-week task force.
Mm-hmm.
The task force said, we are not in a position to find a solution. We're instead going to give a report on shelter best practices. And so they punted. And it's kind of unknown what's going to happen. Part of that process was the city did a land scan where they basically looked to see what other properties are on the market. And they said that there wasn't anything else that was that met any of the specifications on sale at the time. And really that there wasn't a magic bullet of this special site just sitting there waiting for Interfaith to move to. The neighbors don't agree with that assertion. Katie Decker, one of the leaders of the Veterans Park Neighborhood Association, you know, she has said to me and kind of alluded that there might have been other properties that were not looked at and not considered in that land scan. I don't have all the details. So I've seen other neighbors on social media pitching and in the hearings pitching other ideas, but really what it comes down to is what's for sale, what's the price, and can Interfaith Sanctuary, you know, pull it off. As far as your question about if the city of Boise can force them to move to another site, force isn't really the right word. So you know, I suppose if the city turns down Interfaith's proposal and it loses in court or any of these other, you know, outcomes that make it not viable, I suppose the city of Boise could step in and find a site for the shelter and do some sort of land swap or purchase it for them. I don't really know how that works. But we haven't really gotten to that point yet, and it's unclear exactly how far the city of Boise is willing to step in to help provide emergency homelessness services. So far, they have taken a step back and said emergency homeless services is something that nonprofits handle. That's what the nonprofits do, and that's their job. And I haven't seen a ton of willingness to say, yes, we're going to take on this issue. So we really don't know what's going to happen if the project is turned down and a new solution needs to be found.
Okay. Well, and we do know that in January, Boise Planning and Zoning Commission turned down the shelter's application to move to State Street. So that's why we're having these hearings that begin today. So, Margaret, very quickly, how will the hearings work? Who can testify?
Right. So not just anyone can testify. If you testified during the planning and zoning hearings, you can testify this week. And they're going to go with people who come to City Hall in person first and then go to folks who are online. And if you want to testify online, you're going to need to sign up. There's information on the City of Boise's website. But yes, so because this is an appeal from planning and zoning, not just anyone can come down. If you were a party of record in planning and zoning, then you can testify. And so if you have any questions about your status, I'm sure the city of Boise would be happy to check it with you before you go down there and wait hours and hours in order to testify. I would just contact their department and see. Again, there's 5 days of hearings. They're going to do it all this week and see what they can see. So there is ample time to find out if you can testify and what your status is.
And then, Margaret, the city council will take a vote. What happens once they take a vote? I mean, let's say the vote is to move forward with allowing them to move to the State Street location. You did mention lawsuits. So, I mean, that could be anything, right? Even if the answer is yes, you can move, because I would assume a lawsuit could be brought that then make, you know, you can put a stay on that so they can't move, or they could move, but there's still a lawsuit. I mean, I think, Margaret, it sounds like whatever they vote, this is, as you said in the beginning of this interview, this is the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. And whenever I say a lawsuit, that's kind of what I mean, is that if no matter what happens, it is expected that either side will then appeal this to a judge in a process called judicial review, where you basically, it's not really a lawsuit per se, but you're basically taking the project to court and asking a judge to look at it and see if the city of Boise's approval or disapproval is legal under Idaho code. And then from there, whatever that district judge decides, that can be further appealed to the Idaho Supreme Court. That process is going on now with the Northwest Neighborhood Association and the Promenade Subdivision. So this is a long process. And if it gets a vote yes, and then the neighbors appeal it to in judicial review, the project cannot start until a judge says this project is worthy. I mean, this would not be a case where Interfaith Sanctuary would start building and then a judge would rule no 6 months from now. So just keep an eye on this process. It's going to be ongoing for a long time.
Yeah. So, Margaret, you have been writing about the problem of homelessness in Boise for quite a while now. I know it's a big ask for you to give us an overview of what you've seen in the last few years, but if you could just kind of give us an understanding of what we have been seeing and where we are in terms of this crisis that's going on.
Right. Things are really, really tight out there. Rents are going up. Property values are going up. It seems like wherever you turn, housing prices are climbing higher and higher. I regularly see people talking about several $100 a month rent increases, all sorts of just very large price hikes, sometimes overnight.
And Margaret, BoiseDev.com, in fact, has an entire section on your website called Housing Crunch. So how big then would you say this issue is in our entire state? And I realize that your organization focuses mainly on Boise, the greater Treasure Valley, but we are seeing this throughout the state.
Correct. And I'm going to zoom out further beyond Idaho to say that this is a national problem across the country. Almost nearly every metro area is seeing large increases in housing prices, difficulty for first-time buyers to find properties, rising rents, all sorts of things. I mean, and there's multiple factors for that, but this is a really, really tough issue. And for a long time, it has been only a Boise issue. And I think a lot of people who live outside of Boise have said, okay, that's a big city problem. That's a liberal problem. We don't have that problem. We don't need to engage with it. But that's just not going to be the case anymore, as some of these smaller metros like Pocatello and Idaho Falls and Twin Falls, Coeur d'Alene has long had housing price issues because they're a resort area. They're going to start seeing more and more people flooding in, more demand for homes, higher rents, building that can't keep up with the demand for new housing. It's all exploding everywhere. And I think that sort of pressure on housing, not just being the Boise problem, not just being the liberal problem, really, we saw it this year in the Idaho State Legislature, where legislators narrowly approved $50 million of ARPA funding to fund public-private partnerships to build workforce housing, the majority of which needs to be built in rural areas. We also saw the Idaho Senate stop a bill that would have removed Boise's $30 rental application fee cap. I think that I got the sense from legislators that maybe they did not love using federal money to address the housing crisis, but they know it's coming for their area, and it is coming for their area. Mm-hmm.
And Margaret, you know, another big issue is housing prices. And this is something that, of course, you have been covering at Boise Dev. But it's not just the cost of housing. You mentioned this. It's also the cost of rent and rents rising. So what have we seen over the last year or two? And has this issue been compounded by the pandemic?
Absolutely. A big part of why this issue has been compounded is we were having in-migration before, but things exploded in the last year with more and more people from large metro areas who are now remote workers or, you know, seeking a change, moving into places like Idaho, moving out of the biggest cities in the country, in the world, and moving here and moving to mid-sized metros. And that has really changed the whole landscape of where people are living and working. And then you have the added pressure on top of it of Wall Street speculating in real estate and buying homes as investors and buying rental properties, you know, with hedge fund money that we didn't see 3-4 years ago. And I've written about that, where, you know, as much as a fifth of properties bought and sold in Boise last year were from investors. That mm-hmm. is a real factor. And so when you combine the actual scarcity of we don't have enough housing for folks with the added investor pressure, it turns into a absolute intense situation that really is hurting nearly everyone in our community, or at least someone that everyone in our community knows.
And then with that, Margaret, you put the rising property taxes on it, because there are people who may even own their home outright, but are afraid that they can no longer afford to even stay in the home that they own outright. You know, we're talking no mortgage, but it's the property taxes. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there are so many factors going into why property taxes are rising so much. A big part of it is because of the structure of Idaho's property tax system, where your property tax value is determined by your relative value compared to everybody else. And so as residential properties have become so much more valuable, so much quicker than commercial properties like big box stores, all these sorts of things, it means that homeowners are taking on a bigger and bigger burden of the property tax, of their share of property taxes. I did a story about this last year where I went and compared commercial properties to residential properties. And there was a tower in downtown Boise that is now paying thousands of dollars less in taxes than it used to, because homeowners are paying more. And so there's a lot of pressure there. And also local governments, it's really hard for them to slow down on hiking property taxes sometimes, because you've got all these new subdivisions, you have all these new folks, and they want schools and they want fire stations and they want the police mm-hmm. to show up to their house. And there's all sorts of, it's basically layer upon layer of structural things that are pressing on every single Idahoan's wallets right now.
So let's talk about the solutions to the high cost of living. You have covered many proposals by the Idaho legislature. So what did they end up doing this year?
So not much. There was a proposal from Senator Jim Rice that would essentially hike the sales tax in exchange for almost entirely removing every property tax off of homeowners. That got pulled toward the end of the session because it sounds like there were so many questions about how that would impact local government budgets, how that would impact consumers, that they said that Rice and others said, okay, we're going to bring this back next year. And so there was really a pause on what to do. But in the past, the Idaho legislature has relied on caps on local mm-hmm. government budget increases in order to control this. Particularly House Majority Leader Mike Moyle strongly believes that the key to property tax relief is not really addressing the burden of who's paying what and how much, but restricting local government budgets, because they're the ones who set those budgets. They decide how much money they're going to spend and how much we have to pay. And so the Idaho legislature has been really laser focused on how do we stop local governments from hiking taxes nearly as much as they have been. And which in response, local governments aren't happy because they say we need to pay for growth. So mm-hmm. it's a tough nut to crack.
What about the issue, Margaret, of wages? Because here we have this, you know, these rising prices when it comes to housing. And yet our wages are nowhere near what they should be in order to be able to afford this. And I think we're seeing this even more because, as you mentioned, we have investors coming in from other states, right? Or we have people moving in from other states who can purchase these homes at these elevated prices. Because they are coming from locations where not only were they able to sell a home for more because of the pandemic, they're also able to telecommute now and continue making these higher wages. That's not the case, though, for people who are based in Idaho making Idaho wages.
That's absolutely true. Idaho has long lagged behind other areas and states in the Mountain West for wages, largely because we're an relatively isolated community. And so employers didn't have to pay as much because they weren't competing for workers. And now with the internet and teleworking, it is the wild, wild west out there. I did a story earlier this year about how large tech companies are coming in and recruiting Idaho folks specifically because they can pay them more than anyone else in Idaho can, but they don't have to pay them New York levels or San Francisco right. levels in order for them to be comfortable here. And it's completely changing the dynamic. But at the end of the day, if you're a remote worker and you make $200,000 and you can buy a really nice home in Eagle or Meridian or Boise with your remote working money, you still want to go to the Flying M and get a chai latte, and you want the person who makes that chai latte to do a good job. And in order for the person making your chai latte to do a good job, they need a place to live. And right. whenever you sort of create this economy where the only way to afford to live here is to have an employer that's based elsewhere, the question becomes, how do those service workers, those teachers, those cops, those firefighters, or even, you know, reporters like me live here and, you know, continue to contribute to the community whenever it really is starting to take out of state money to support a family? I think right. that is going to be a question we're going to have to deal with in the next coming years, because everyone loves that chai latte. But in order for that chai latte to stay affordable, that business owner needs to pay someone a lower wage. And in return, that person needs to find a place to rent that they can afford on that lower wage. So it all goes back to housing.
Yeah, I really appreciate your reporting on this, Margaret, and coming on the program. We've been talking with Margaret Carmel. She is senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, talking about housing and homelessness here in Idaho. If you haven't checked out Margaret's reporting, go to BoiseDev.com and do that. Honestly, in-depth reporting on this housing crisis that we are facing. Up next, we'll continue our look at the housing crunch outside of the state of Idaho. Margaret, again, thank you for your time today.
Loved it. Thank you.
More Idaho Matters right now. As we continue our look at homelessness in Boise, we actually wanted to include the fact that this issue, as Margaret Carmel noted in our last segment, is not limited to our capital city or to other cities in Idaho in general. Affordable housing shortages in cities and resort towns in our region are well documented. However, many residents of the rural Mountain West are also finding it harder to stay housed as waves of gentrification move inland from the coast.
Winnemucca, Nevada lies in the Great Basin, an hour south of the Oregon border. High desert peaks rise sharply on all sides, and a sea of sagebrush stretches to the horizon. Leslie Reed lives in an RV park near the golf course with five rescue dogs, one cat, and two Russian tortoises.
I have made my life. I have made my life so easy after I got divorced. I made sure everything was cash.
Reed's exactly the kind of person you'd expect to meet out here. She's self-sufficient, stubborn, and doesn't mind getting her hands dirty.
I don't live in neighborhoods, okay? I have the animals, I like my privacy, things like that. My illness has forced me to move to town now.
Reed's 63 years old. Her illness includes difficulty breathing and heart trouble. Back in July, she says it got so bad that when she tried to work, she'd end up on the floor, nauseous and struggling for breath. So she lost her job at a local laundromat, and that put her in a real jam. In Winnemucca, where the population is just over 8,000 people, rents are climbing fast.
Affordable housing is few and far between.
Elaine Nye directs the nonprofit Frontier Community Action Agency. She and her staff were able to get Reed on the wait list for a federal rent subsidy. While she waits, Reed's landlord is letting her keep the spot where she parks her fifth wheel. But many of her neighbors haven't been so lucky. Nye says the agency's caseload grew after COVID hit because so many folks lost their jobs.
Our list with people living in motels, there's 71 living in motels right now, and that's the highest number that we've ever had.
The Nevada Rural Housing Authority is also working on the crisis. It recently bought two apartment complexes in Winnemucca that it plans to rent to seniors and very low-income households. For example, a family of four making less than $42,000 a year could move in. One of those is the Mountain View Apartments. During a site visit a few months ago, half the units still had the original faded blue siding. Across the parking lot, the rest had been cut open to show reflective sheets of new insulation.
If we go in the kitchen, you can see they've got new cabinetry, and you can see the installation of the new flooring going in.
Beth Dunning works for the Housing Authority. These apartments should open up next winter, but it would have been a lot sooner if they didn't have to bring supplies and contractors in from Reno and Las Vegas. On top of that, they're dealing with COVID-related delays.
Mechanical equipment has taken us longer to obtain than we would like. Furnaces, fan coil units.
Meanwhile, the housing shortage isn't just bad for people like Leslie Reed. Local officials say it's a big problem for employers, too. Jan Morrison runs economic development for Humboldt County, which includes Winnemucca.
You can't have employees if they don't have a place to go home to at night.
Morrison says the local economy is on track to add more than 2,000 jobs over the next 5 years. There aren't enough locals to fill them. She says nearby gold and silver mines are helping drive up prices, too. On average, Nevada miners make more than $120,000 a year.
They can afford a higher price. And if we don't have the product for them to move into, they're going to move into what they can get.
And what they can get is often the housing that lower-income residents used to depend on. According to Ryan Pilgrim, the influx of well-paid workers, like Humboldt County's miners or remote employees who left big cities during the pandemic, is pushing working class residents out.
Rural communities are every bit as inundated with global economic forces and laws as the Bay Area.
Pilgrim is an associate professor at the University of Idaho who studies rural gentrification. She says the economic shifts moving inland are a wake-up call for Idaho and other Western states.
We can look at what's happened in California and think, do we want this to be our fate?
Pilgrim says it'll take political will to confront the crisis. But just like affordable housing, that can be hard to develop. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Bert Johnson.
Meantime, millions in donations have poured in for hundreds of people who lost their homes in Colorado's Marshall Fire. But not far from the ashes, advocates are looking for money to address a crisis of chronic homelessness. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent reports, this reflects our attitudes on the issue.
It's nearing 5 p.m. on a frigid evening in Boulder, and Elizabeth Cutler is waiting for the city's homeless shelter to open. She's sitting in the lobby with her walker.
With the snow, the bearings are going out on my wheels, so I try not to use my walker at night because the wheels will squeak and I don't want to wake people up.
The former caseworker suffers from a debilitating spinal condition. In 2010, it got so bad she had to stop working. She receives disability benefits, but medical bills were adding up and soon became unmanageable. Then she got evicted. She lived in a van for 8 years with her little dog, Daisy May. That time was a glimmer amid her struggles with homelessness.
It was much better for me. You know, if I didn't like my neighbors, I could move.
But it didn't last.
The transmission went out, and then my little dog died, and I wound up here.
It's notoriously difficult to find affordable housing in Boulder. Last October, Rent Cafe listed the average one bedroom here at more than $2,200 per month. The median sale price for a home, meanwhile, is nearly $1 million. Interim shelter director Spencer Downing.
So in a place where house prices are going up, it tends to follow pretty closely that you're going to see a rise in homelessness. And we're going to see that, especially after the fires.
In December, the Marshall Fire ravaged more than 1,000 homes in Boulder County. There's been an outpouring of financial support for the victims, a heartening display of generosity. Still, it contrasts the reactions to those experiencing chronic homelessness. Downing says that's because we're drawn to the concept of the deserving poor, those who can't be blamed for their misfortune.
Whereas if there's something that makes it seem like that was somehow a person's fault that they are poor or that their bad decision making resulted in this, it's harder for us to think about, well, what are the systems that gave their decisions such a small range?
Lack of affordable housing is a major problem. Throw medical bills into the equation and virtually no friends or family to lean on, and you could lose your home, like Elizabeth Cutler. Downing says donations at the shelter are down in comparison to last year, and it may be due to people choosing instead to donate to fire victims. This is playing out while Boulder continues to enforce its camping ban.
They need to fix this. They can't keep making it a crime for people essentially to be homeless in Boulder.
That's attorney Annie Kurtz with the Colorado American Civil Liberties Union. She's taken up this issue with Boulder.
As long as there are folks in your community that can't meaningfully access the shelter, it is a violation of the Constitution.
The shelter has had to turn people away due to capacity issues, and a recent investigation by the nonprofit Boulder Reporting Lab found police were issuing camping tickets when that was happening in December. Boulder Mayor Aaron Brockett defends the ban and says it's being enforced with more compassionate discretion. He says people camping along creeks and in parks isn't a viable solution.
There's no sanitation, there's no trash services. There's no connection to, you know, mental health support.
Boulder has placed more than 100 people into homes. And in a win for housing advocates, the city is moving forward with plans to open a day shelter.
The vision is to create a center where folks can go during the day and get out of the cold.
Folks that we're in right now are members of the Deserve Better program.
Back at the shelter, people are lining up. Interim Director Downing expects to reach capacity of 145 tonight as the temperature drops into the 20s. The former history professor compares the public's tolerance for homelessness to other past moral failures, like slavery. At some point, it became reprehensible.
How are you able to know that there are people sleeping outside without anything and that you accept that that's just kind of how things are? I hope that in the future, people will be astonished by us.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Robin Vincent.
The affordable housing crisis has driven some people to try long-term camping on federal lands, and that is illegal, and authorities are pushing to clear them off land or to fine them, as Madeline Beck reports from the Mountain West News Bureau.
It's a sunny, windy day on public lands outside Boise, Idaho. It's mostly fields of sagebrush. Beside a road, there's a substantial white, blue, and gray trailer in nice condition. It looks like something you'd see in any campsite.
We're out here today just to monitor this camp that's been in overstay for a while now.
Becky Andrews is the Idaho State Chief Ranger for the Bureau of Land Management. An overstay is someone who's on an area of public land longer than a set limit, usually 14 days. This trailer has been around for about 2 months.
And we've been patiently working with them as they work through their situation and try to find more sustainable housing.
It's not new for people to live on public lands. For a short time in the 90s, a designated camp was even set up on Forest Service land in Oregon for people who were homeless. And around the 2008 recession, BLM officers say there was a spike in people moving to public lands. Over the last 3 years, high housing prices forced another increase in forest residents. BLM officer Brian Adams says it's increased a lot.
Tenfold, at least. It's something we deal with in the field every single day.
At another location, there are several vehicles, some functional, others not. Adams says it's a family with kids, something he's seeing more of.
I have a daughter, she's six, and seeing that the kids in that situation, it's heartbreaking. They shouldn't be worrying about housing issues when they're, you know, you're 6 years old. You should be worried about playing.
There are many kinds of people living on public lands. Some have mental health challenges that make employment hard. Others have jobs but can't find housing in their price range. Some are even students or seasonal employees. And then there are people who just prefer living outdoors.
A lot of us are really kind of introverts in a way. We like the solitude, the peace and quiet, the time to read.
Steve Johnson and his wife used to live on public lands all over the West, traveling around as nomads, working on their laptops. They have a house in Oklahoma now, but he says they might return to public lands living after their pandemic hiatus. He says living without rent or a mortgage saves money, but he cautions that most true nomads moving from state to state aren't poor.
I met one guy who lives in a car, and he has a tent, and he just travels around the country. He's actually an IT professional, but he just can't live with in neighborhoods, you know, or suburbs.
A 2015 survey of Forest Service law enforcement found that the largest group of people living on those public lands were senior nomadic campers. But public lands officials say people who regularly move and clean up aren't the problem. Land overuse, human waste, and garbage are, and they're expensive to clean up. So some places have tightened up rules, like around Jackson, Wyoming. Mary Cernicek is a Forest Service spokesperson with Bridger Teton National Forest.
Our piece right around Jackson is limited to 5 days.
That's compared to 14 days in most national forests. Cernicek says that has helped keep the numbers of people living there steady. They police the area more, too, and recently fined one man $2,000 and banned him from the Bridger Teton Forest for 3 years after he was warned and continued living there.
As a land management agency, the Bridger Teton is responsible to solve problems associated with resource impacts and public safety. It is not to provide alternatives for communities for housing.
Dispersed camping areas, or those without bathrooms or developments that have been overtaxed or abused, can be closed, like some around the Arapaho and Roosevelt National Forests. There are wildfire concerns, too. How do you warn these people about an approaching fire? And what if they start one? Back in Idaho, Becky Andries with the BLM says their goal is to partner with more social service groups to help people find housing.
I really hope that we can educate our public and our society to understand that it's a difficult situation for everybody.
She hopes communities all around the West band together, help those who need it, and keep public lands healthy for generations to come. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
The stories we've heard today about housing and homelessness from the Mountain West News Bureau are part of their occasional series, Priced Out. You can find a link to those stories on our website, BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. As we mentioned at the top of the show, the Boise City Council will begin 5 days of hearings on the future of Interfaith Sanctuary. Those hearings happen this afternoon. We will put a link on our website to the council hearings, which you can watch live online, and we will be covering those proceedings and the eventual vote by council members right here on Idaho Matters. A big thank you to all of you for joining us on this Monday. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our assistant producer is Hannah Gardosky. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here tomorrow.